Okay, so let's begin. We are studying the Parshiot of the Mishkan. This week's Parsha is officially Vayakal Pekudei. We're going to talk about the Aron. So the Aron, we're told, this week's Parsha as well, everything is pretty much repeated in Vayakal Pekudei. All of the instructions for building the Beit HaMikdash are repeated in these Parshiot. And just at the end, the Parsha Vayakal, we have a repetition of the Kelim. So the first thing mentioned is the Aron. I believe it's also the first one that Moshe was commanded to, commissioned or commanded to build, to create. So one of the unique features of the Aron is its structure. So officially, it is made up of a few different boxes. The way the Torah describes it is in source number one, Vasu Aron Atzei Shitim, Amatayim V'chetzi Orko, V'chetzi Rechpo, V'chetzi Komato. Those are the measurements in terms of width, length, height, and then its form or its color, coloring is in pasuk yedalef. It's ipitel to zahav tahor mi baidu michutz titzapenu vasita lav zer zahav saviv. So we're told that the Aron has to be covered, gilded. I'm going to call it that. Covered from out of gold. From the inside and from the outside. So yes, it is the name of a movie, Inside Out, but it's also the translation of the word mibayru michutz, right? From the inside and the outside of the Aron, it has to be gold. Now, the problem is that the first pasuk says that it's wood, right? There's wood. So how does that work? So Rashi explains in source number two that there were actually three boxes. There were three arcs. One, like the stacking blocks, right? One inside the other, inside the other. So the inner one and the outer one were gold, and the one in the middle, which you didn't see once it was all covered, is made out of wood, or just wood. Two of gold and one of wood. Each one had four walls on the bottom, and they were open on the top, right? You placed the wooden one inside the golden one, and then the other golden one inside the wooden one. Covered the upper room with gold, thus is found the wooden one was overlaid. So when it says, Mibayru Michutz Titzapenu, inside out, gold covering, it means that you wouldn't be able to recognize that there was actually wood in there.
Wait.
You wouldn't be, if you took off the top of the Aron, you wouldn't see that the middle box, you wouldn't see this layer on the inside in between the two boxes of wood. It would just be completely painted over, however they did it. I guess they poured the gold over it, however they did it, but completely hidden. The wood would be completely hidden. So when it says mibayru michutz, it means you wouldn't be able to recognize that there's wood in the middle.
Wait, so was it like three separate boxes, or was it like a wooden box that's like covered?
It's three separate boxes. Oh. One box made out of full gold, The next box, a little bit smaller, fit perfectly inside, fully out of wood. Okay. The next box, a little bit smaller, fully out of gold. And then they would cover the whole thing on top, so you wouldn't even know that there's some, that you would look at it, you'd say there's a gold box from inside and out. That's what Hashem wanted, and that's how Bezalel, the grand architect of the Mishkan, that's how he ended up designing it. And you might ask a question, why design it this way if you're never going to know there's any wood inside? Like, what's the point of the wood if... So there's two answers to that question. One is a simple, pragmatic answer. Source number three, the Chizkuni writes that it's to make it lighter. People are going to be carrying this box. This wasn't a box that went on a cart, like some of the other items from the Mishkan. This was something that people actually had to carry on their back. So to lighten the load, one of the boxes was made out of wood. It will lighten it a lot, because if you had three, the equivalent of three boxes made out of gold, it would be a lot heavier. Comment? You want to say something on it?
Gold weighs so much.
Gold weighs so much. So, and it's expensive, but...
They couldn't have one box?
So, meaning, why not just... Okay, why not just design one box?
Yeah.
That's a good question. It had to be made out of wood, though, and gold.
Right.
So you have to figure out a way to... Right. So that's how the Chizkuni, one of the early commentaries, explains the kind of the purpose of the wood.
Right.
But there is a second function of the wood, which we'll try to explain in the coming coming sources. So there's a Gemara in source number 4 that says that the idea of the Aron being gold on the inside and gold on the outside is also metaphorical or symbolic of the way that a Jew should live their life. And in the message of it is here in source 4, Mibayde Michutz Tzepenu Amarava Kol Tamechacham Shein Tocho Kavaro Eino Tamechacham. A person who doesn't have their inside like their outside cannot be called a Tamechacham. It's another way of saying being a consistent personality, meaning who you are on the inside, should be reflected on the outside of who you are. Your behavior should reflect your thoughts, for example, or your emotions. So this idea of being a consistent personality is the paradigm for that is the Aron, or the model for that is the Aron. The way that we can understand in Torah structure, looking at something to gain inspiration from, let's look at the Aron and let's say, hey, here's the Aron, this is gold on the inside, gold on the outside, that's how a person should be. They should be a consistent type of personality. The only problem is there was wood in the middle. So we have to understand what did Chazal mean when they said this statement. So there's a story in the Gemara, in source number 5. I only brought the end of the story, but the beginning of the story is basically a debate between different rabbis about the prayer, the nighttime prayer, Mariv. Mariv, as opposed to Shacharit and Mincha, does not have the reflective nature of being comparable to a korban. So we have the korbanot that were brought every day, the korban tamid, two korbanot, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, 365, 7 days a week. And those korbanot were used as the model when we don't no longer have a Beit HaMikdash for prayer. So shacharit is going to reflect the morning korban, and mincha is going to reflect the afternoon korban. There's no nighttime korban. So where does the nighttime prayer come from? So it's possible that the prayers also come from Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. The Gemara addresses that as well, but the assumption is in its core, in its root, it's really a reflection of the korbanot. If so, shacharit and mincha have a obligatory nature to them because those were sacrifices that were brought every morning and every afternoon. Marv, there was nothing. The only thing they did at Marv is they took all the leftover fats and stuff and they burned it through the night. But there's no special korban that was brought at night. Therefore, and this is really the conclusion, should Mariv be obligatory or should it be optional? And that's the question the Gemara raises. So one of the students in the time wanted to understand the time of the Gemara, wanted to know what the answer was. So he went over to one rabbi and he said, what do you think? Should Mariv be optional? Should be obligatory? So he said it should be optional. Then he went over to Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Nasi, who was the head of the yeshiva, and he said, what do you think about this? And he said it should be obligatory, chayav. So he said, oh, but the other rabbi told me, a person should never do this. That's the lesson. But the other rabbi told me that it's optional. So he kind of said, okay, so they come into the Beit Midrash. He said, let's wait till everybody comes in and let's discuss it. Public conversation, public discussion. So they come into the Beit Midrash. Everybody's discussing it. It's a whole back and forth. He says, does anybody here, want to disagree? The question was asked. He said, and so the head of the yeshiva said, it's obligatory. So he said, does anybody disagree with me? So everyone was silent. Nobody wanted to say anything. So then he told the rabbi, he knew that there was somebody who argued with his opinion. His name was Rabbi Yeshua. And he said, I want you to stand up and I want you to tell the truth. And essentially he was upset that he hadn't initially said something. So what does he do? He makes him stand on his feet for the rest of the shiur. Now all the students in the room get very upset. It's not a nice thing to make this guy stand on his feet. So they decide to impeach him. Now there was precedent. He had done this a few times before, and they felt that it wasn't appropriate and wasn't nice. So they decide he's no longer going to be the Rosh Hashiva anymore. We're going to replace him. So the whole debate who we're going to replace him with. First they suggest Rabbi Yeshua himself. They say it's not a good idea. He was like involved in the story. Then they suggest Rabbi Akiva. Problem with Rabbi Akiva, he doesn't have enough strong yichus because he comes from converts. whole discussion there. And then they come to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the young 18-year-old scholar, he says, they say he's great, he's got all of the check marks that we want, criteria for Rosh Hashiva. Turns out, he doesn't have a beard. He comes home to his wife. His wife says, maybe they'll take you out. They have a whole back and forth, it's an interesting discussion. Then in the end, she says, all right, it's not a bad idea, but no one's going to respect you because you don't have a beard. So he realizes it might be an issue. Miracle happens. This is the story we say in the Haggadah, right, every year. Haggadah Shel Pesach, Harei Ani Kiven Shivim Shana. It's like I'm 70 years old, but he's really only 18 years old. So he grows a beard overnight, basically. Fine. So he becomes Rosh Hashiva. On that day, here we go, source number 5. Now jump in. On that day, they removed Rabbi Gamliel from his position, appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah in his place. They dismissed the guard at the door. There had been a guard standing at the door in the time of Rabbi Gamliel. Permission was granted for students to enter. Instead of Rabbi Gamliel's selective approach that asserted the students must be screened before accepting them into the study hall, the new approach asserted that anyone who seeks a study should be given an opportunity to do so. So Rabbi Gamliel would proclaim and say, any student who's inside, his thoughts and feelings are not like his outside. Okay? Kol ha-talmid she'ein tocho kebaro, al yikenes le-bein ha-midrash. His conduct, his character, traits are lacking, will not enter the study hall. So a lot of discussion, how did they figure that out? Like the guards at the door during Rabbi Gamliel's time, how could they figure out what people, you know, where people are, what they're feeling inside? So one of the commentaries says, in source number 7, he says that the admissions policy itself was what turned people away. Once people heard, you're only allowed to come to this yeshiva if you are tocho kebaro, your inside reflects your outside. Yeah. Then anyone who heard that would make a judgment about themselves. Either I'm appropriate or I'm not appropriate. Either I belong in this yeshiva or I don't belong. They didn't need to actually like interview anyone. It's a good system, right? Everyone just self-selected. So that was one opinion. Others say there was actually always a guard in the yeshivas because a lot of the yeshivas were out in the outside of the city and they needed protection. So the guard at the door wasn't necessarily there for checking people, but just was. So what happened the day the Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he took the guard away, or he relaxed the admissions policy, however you want to understand it. And it says, on that day, several benches were added to the study hall. Some people say it was 400 benches, some people it was 700 benches. The point is, there were all these people who really wanted to learn in this yeshiva, but were unable to get in, because this admissions policy was so strict. And on that day, because of the new great number of students who came in, there was this a great kind of influx of Torah, of new Torah that was learned on that day because of all the new students who came in. And Rabbi Gamliel obviously is very sad. He sees how many people weren't able to be in the yeshiva because of his strict policy. So he has a dream, and that night, if you look in the last 6 lines, when he saw the tremendous growth in the number of students, Rabbi Gamliel was disheartened. He said, maybe I prevented Israel from engaging in Torah study. They showed him, in his dream, white jugs filled with ashes, alluding to the fact that the additional students were worthless idlers. Which basically means they wanted Rabbi Gamliel to not feel so bad. All the people that came in, really, you know, really, they weren't the best types of people that were coming in.
They still wanted to learn.
Well, it says, look, that's not the case, but that dream was shown to him to ease his mind so that he would not feel bad. Okay, so really Rabbi Gamliel was wrong. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's policy was more open and liberal, if you want to call it that, to let people in, more people in, who weren't necessarily of perfect, perfected, pristine character. But the obvious question is, all the people, you know, it's like, all the people who really needed to be in the yeshiva couldn't get in. Because the whole point of yeshiva is to help improve a person's being, and give them more knowledge to our knowledge, and help them become better people. And all the people who were already perfected, not that they didn't need the yeshiva, but they didn't need it as much as the other guys who couldn't even get in. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah did something good for the world, for the Jewish people. Rabbi Gamliel was preventing something. What was the debate about? What were they really debating? Go ahead.
Was this like the only yeshiva there? Like there wasn't?
In that area, probably, presumably. That's a good question. Rav Kook, I'm not going to read it inside, in source number 8, he points out the idea what they were really debating was, how do we view human beings? Do we view people as more driven toward doing the right thing? It's just who they are, like in their nature. Or do we view people as hardwired, not driven toward doing the right thing, but rather driven toward doing the wrong thing, and therefore we need to fix them, right? Do people need to be fixed, or are people just naturally going to pick the right thing And sometimes they might mess up. But when they mess up, it's not a reflection of their character. So that was, yeah, that's what he explains what the debate was. All people are inherently good. If they mess up, they do something wrong, they speak Lashon Hara, it was a momentary Yetzer Hara. You know, it was something that they didn't, it's not who they are. Inside, they're really good. Right, we say Elohai, Neshama Shenatata Bi Tehorai. That's one perspective. The other perspective, the soul that's inside of me is pure. The other perspective is, people are prone to evil, or people are prone to sin. So that was Rabbi Gamliel. And he said, we need to have a strict policy. We can't just let anybody in. So what does it mean, Tocho Kabaro? Tocho Kabaro, in source number 9, the Maharsha explains, a person learns Torah, but doesn't have Yirat Shemayim. If you look at the end of source 9. He might know all of Shas, you know, he might know all of the Talmud off by heart. But he's not a nice person, so it's great. Inside of him, he knows everything, but his behavior is not reflective of all the Torah that that person learned. So that's one explanation of Tocho Kabaro. The Rambam in Source 10 has a different explanation of Tocho Kabaro. He says it's, you know, what you feel in your heart, you speak differently with your mouth. So it's almost like being tricky. He gives an example, right? Person is forbidden to act in a smooth tongue, luring manner. He should not speak one thing outwardly and think otherwise in his heart. Rather, his inner self should be like the self which he shows to the world. What he feels in his heart should be the same as the words on his lips. Turn the page. So this is fascinating. So the Pri Chadash, who's a commentary on the Rambam, he says that the Rambam's halacha of being consistent in your speech with how you feel in your heart, it's based on the story that we just studied together. It's based on that story itself. And he writes, when Rabbi Gamliel said, you have to be Tocho Kabaro, right? That was based on Rabbi Gamliel. So that's what the Rambam is writing. A person should be truthful. You should try to be as blunt as you can. You have to be a nice person. But you shouldn't be inconsistent. We're going to see at the end, there was an interesting question. If a person sees someone, doesn't really like that person, so are you supposed to pretend like you like them? Halakha question. Right? Interesting, right? Yeah. Right? Okay, we'll see at the end. We'll do that last. So one example of this, by the way, is Kalev. Remember the story of the Miraglim, of the spies? So what happens is Kalev is one of the 12 who doesn't give a bad report. He also doesn't give a good report. He doesn't either. He tricks the Miraglim into believing that he's on their side. And then at the last moment, when everybody said their piece, he stands up and they're like, oh, he's going to put the cherry on top. And then he says, no, we can conquer the land, So that's called Ruach Acheret Aitaimo. Look in Source 12, this is Bamidbar. Hashem says Kalev's going to get a special reward because he had a second spirit inside of him. And Rashi writes, second spirit means Echad Bapev, Echad Balev. What he said to the other 12, the other 11, is that I'm with you. Yeah, Eretz Yisrael, yeah, it's not a good place, it's scary, we shouldn't go there. But in his heart, he really believed that Hashem is on our side and we can win and we can conquer the land. So that's how he was able to get up and give a positive spin, because they all thought he was on his side. So that's using the idea of being consistent, being inconsistent, in a positive way.
What if it was like the opposite, like in his heart he was with the Miraglim and then he just said...
Well, either way, the inconsistency is not a good thing. Well, I'm just giving an example of what it could mean to be inconsistent, and here it's being used latov, here it's being used in the positive sense. But, right? And that's, we say this every day in our tefillah, source 13, la'olam yehadam yirei shemayim b'seter kivagali. How we are in private should be the same, how we are in public should be the same way we are in private. But it's not always the case. So these are all kinds of different examples of people who are inconsistent in different places in their life. You know, another kind of formulation of it in 14 is the Mishnah Berakhei Avot that says, don't look at the vessel, but look what's inside of it. Which is, don't judge a book by its cover, because sometimes you might see something on a person, you should get to know a person, speak to them. That's what Rashi says in the comment there. He says, don't just look at a person and judge them based on that. So yes, it's true, a person's supposed to be consistent, but we can't make a full calculation of who a person is until we get to know them better. So here's the question. So what do we do if a student comes to the school and is not a Tocho Kabaro student? Who do we follow, lahalacha? Which opinion do we follow? Do we follow Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who opened the doors and let everybody in? Or do we follow Rabbi Gamliel, who had the strict policy? What should schools' admissions policies be? You asked me before, what was the topic of the shiur? So this is about admissions policies. So the Rambam writes, very interesting, in Source 15, Torah should be taught only to a proper student, one whose deeds are attractive, or to a person whose behavior is unknown. However, and this is Hilchot Talmud Torah, the laws of Talmud Torah, a potential student who follows bad ways should be influenced to correct his behavior. Look at that. So who does the Rambam follow? The Rambam clearly follows Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. That's what the commentary say in Sources 16 and 17. They point out, Kesev Mishnah, the Lechem Mishnah, they're telling us that, yes, it's true, it's not wonderful to not have these positive features of a person, to be consistent personality, but at the end of the day, we're not going to reject the person from the yeshiva because we know that the yeshiva is really going to be good for them, right? They can be influenced to correct their behavior and trained to follow a straight path. And after they do tshuva, and again, so the commentators actually say, I think it's in 17, right? He says that you're innocent until proven guilty. How can we judge a person? How can we know how a person actually is until we've given them a chance?
So then what about schools that actually don't take people?
I think it's very challenging. Again, I think today, when we talk about admissions policies, I work a little bit in admissions, we look at much bigger kinds of factors. Just for example, sometimes a student has special needs, special learning situations. And not every school has the resources to be able to help a student. Doesn't necessarily mean that the person's a bad person, that they can't learn. It just means that that particular school is not equipped to help the student. So there's a lot of factors that go into this. But the idea of midot, right, is obviously a very large one. And if a school says, well, what's the alternative? They're going to go to public school. What's the alternative? They're going to fall off the path. Then maybe we do have a responsibility to bring those students into our school.
But like there are other schools, right?
I'm hoping there are other schools, and if there are other schools that are more suited or more capable or more equipped, then that's going to be the ideal. But in communities that are smaller, that don't have as many options, sometimes a school has to take on a student they wouldn't necessarily be so comfortable taking on, but with the knowledge of we have a responsibility. So it really is an interesting question and kind of outcome, halakhic outcome. Rav Kook just points out that the mashal that was given to Rabbi Gamliel in the dream was a jug filled with ash, right? What's the idea of ashes? Ashes, the property of ashes, you're a scientist, property of ashes is that they can't adhere one to the other. Adhese, it's not a word. Is to adhese, is that a verb? It's one item to glue to the other. Ashes can never be put together. So his point was, if we put all these people into the Beit Midrash, they're not going to be impacted by being in the Beit Midrash. That was the message that they wanted to send to Rabbi Gamliel, to make him feel better. It's okay, you don't have to feel so bad. All the people that went in the yeshiva, it's not even going to be good for them in the yeshiva. But what is the conclusion? It's not true.
Yeah.
Rabbi Gamliel was wrong. Just being in the environment of a yeshiva is going to impact you positively. So let's just wrap up here. There's the mission, Pirkei Avot, Hamidu Talmidim Harba. It's the first mission, the whole Pirkei Avot, right? The Anshei Knesset Agdol. What was the first teaching that came down from the rabbis in Pirkei Avot? You should have a lot of students. You should have a lot of students. That obviously wasn't the opinion and the approach of Rabbi Gamliel. He wanted to have an elite yeshiva. There was also Beit Shammai, who's mentioned here in the commentaries, who also kind of ran the model of Hillel, was the opposite. So in many ways, these types of personalities were running. And it doesn't mean that one's right and one's wrong. It just means that maybe in a certain generation, we need a different kind of approach. We'll conclude with the tshuva. We're not going to do Rav Soloveitchik. It's a beautiful piece. You can look at it on your own. But in the last piece here, he talks about this question that I asked before. So a person's walking down the street. They see someone, and they realize, I have nowhere to run or hide. I have to engage with this person. But I really don't want to engage with them. I'm in a fight with them. I'm not happy with them. I'm not interested in talking to them or even looking at them. But I don't have a choice. So what should I do? If I smile at them, then it's not tohu kabaro. I'm not expressing the true. But if I don't, then maybe I'm doing something worse. Right? Because then I'm being mean. I don't want to be mean. It's all right. What do you think?
You should say hi to them.
Say hi to them.
Yeah.
You should. Okay, so look what he writes. So first he brings the Rambam. What did the Rambam say? You're not allowed to be untruthful. That was the first thing. That was the first thing that we saw. First, he brings around. Look where it says tshuva. Katav rama masula damlan yigatz moedi vrechal kudu pitu. You have to be consistent. Tochol kabaro like the Aaron. And then he goes into this, and then you know he talks about gneva dat. It's like going in a store, looking around. You're not really interested in buying, but you want to try things on and play around. And it's not nice to the store owners. Again, allowed, not allowed. That's it's a different shir altogether. And then he writes, you know what? At the end of the day, we have a mission Pirkei Avot that says you're supposed to greet people b'sever panim yafot. You're supposed to greet people with a smile. And at the end of the day, that's the best thing. The best thing would be to just have a conversation with the person and try to make shalom, if you can. That would be the best thing. If you can't make shalom, it's better to just put on a smile, because that seems to go above. That value of Hashem wants you to give somebody else a smile. And if that, you know, that's, you can get that out of them, maybe that will end up fixing the relationship. So back to our original question, why did the Aron have wood inside? So what do you think? So I think the pshat is. I heard this one of the answers that I heard is that at the end of the day we all have inconsistencies. The wood represents the impossibility of being 100% consistent. And how do we see that? We see in reality. Like, look what happened in the yeshiva. And Rav Kook writes, he says, there were probably people who came into the yeshiva who didn't really deserve to be in there, according to Rabbi Gamliel's standard. But were they impacted positively? Yes. So the wood in the middle is kind of a reflection on the reality of human beings. Yeah. We can try our best, we can do our best, but we're always going to be in a constant struggle. And that, to me, is an inspiring idea, that the Aron is the paradigm for mibayit umichutz, this inside out, this consistency. But at the end of the day, we can try and try and try and try, but we're always going to be working on it. We're always going to be struggling. We're always going to be working harder on it. So that, to me, is a great kind of message and inspiration. I want to make sure.